Have Ray Kurzweil as our next speaker, a National Medal of Technology winner, the founder of numerous companies, a man who has a vision about the future, an ability to understand where trends are going, and has used those trends not only to look farther into the future, but also to look at the relatively near term in the future, because he's been very successful looking into the relatively near term in the future in a number of businesses. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Ray Kurzweil, our evening speaker.
Thanks, Ralph. It's a pleasure to be here. I see quite a few old friends, and I guess some of you are checking out this field for its implications, which will be very significant. I'm going to try to provide some perspective and sort of broaden the view in terms of time frame and in terms of implication for our human civilization, its relationship to other technologies such as biology, artificial intelligence, and so share my perspective on the impact that nanotechnology will have. I'll try to provide that perspective several ways, in terms of the trends that will lead to nanotechnology, the nature of acceleration of technology. I've been tracking technology trends for a few decades now, and technology progresses in an exponential fashion rather than a linear fashion. That might seem obvious, but actually relatively few people take that into consideration, or many people don't take that into consideration when they consider future trends. I'd like to talk about nanotechnology in the context of three profound overlapping revolutions, which sometimes go by the letters GNR, genetics, nanotechnology, and robotics. Genetics is our understanding of biology. I like to refer to it as biotechnology. We're understanding the information processes underlying biology. Biology is an information processing system. We're learning to understand those, reverse engineer the genome, as well as the brain, and we're beginning to get the tools to manipulate that. And nanotechnology is helping us in that regard. And, of course, biology is providing some very powerful building blocks for nanotechnology, and that we're finding we can modify things like DNA, as you heard about earlier today, to provide structural devices and computational devices. DNA turns out to be very flexible in that way, similar to nanotubes. And then R, robotics, it's really artificial intelligence. Strong AI is developing AI systems at the human level, and I want to talk about the prospects for that. We already have the era of narrow AI. A lot of people ask, well, whatever happened to AI, when we actually have hundreds of examples of narrow AI in common use today. It's deeply embedded in our infrastructure. If you get an electrocardiogram, it'll come back with an automatic diagnosis. Same for blood cell images. AI programs are running intensive care units, flying and landing airplanes, guiding intelligent weapons. About $1 trillion of funds in the stock market are controlled by pattern recognition quant systems. My new business is in that particular field, detecting credit card fraud, directing emails and cell phone connections. If all the AI programs that emerge from AI labs were to stop working, our civilization would grind to a halt. That wasn't true 15 years ago. Of course, they're not intelligent enough yet to organize that kind of conspiracy. Now, Eric has talked about, will nanotechnology bring on strong AI? Because nanotechnology would allow us, you know, true nanotechnology, full nanotechnology will provide the means to have nanobots in the brain that could reverse engineer the brain, get very high resolution images that would enable us to understand how the brain works and therefore facilitate strong AI. Strong AI, on the other hand, could facilitate nanotechnology because intelligence is useful for basically everything. So which is going to come first? Which will facilitate the other? They clearly coming hand in hand. I do think we'll have these three overlapping revolutions in the order of GNR. Genetics is already underway. We're in the early stages of this revolution. Nanotechnology, we do have early adopter technologies, nanoparticles. It's certainly an early adopter technologies, and we have intricate systems very often adapted from biology beginning to work in experiments. The golden era of nanotechnology, in my view, is 15 years or so away. And then strong AI, I've actually stuck with this date for a couple decades now. I have a bet with Mitch Kapor that we will have human-level intelligence, machines, non-biological systems that can pass the Turing test by 2029. We spent months defining what is a machine, what is a human in terms of a human judge and so on. But these three revolutions will transform our society, and they're very and they are overlapping. And the letters GNR sort of burst on our awareness in terms of articles that talked about the downside of GNR. I think Bill Joy was one of the first to use GNR in his famous cover story for Wired magazine, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. New York Times said that that article had more articles commenting on it than any other article in human history, 10,000 by their count. And it was controversial because it talked about relinquishing those technologies. Bill said, I, Bill Joy, am not anti-technology, as, you know, he is the creator of Java, co-founder of Sun. So let's keep those good technologies, but those dangerous ones, you know, like genetics and nanotechnology and robotics, let's just not do those. And I pointed out that those perilous technologies are the same ones that are the beneficial ones. And they're also inevitable because they're not being done in a few dark government laboratories. Nanotechnology, in my view, is the inevitable end result of hundreds of steps towards miniaturizing technology, which is another one of these broad trends, which I'll comment further about. I mean, to shut down GNR, you'd have to shut down technology. That would only be feasible in sort of a brave new world totalitarian system. That was the whole point of that novel. The technology was too dangerous to let it out into the open, so it should be controlled. So the government banned technology development, and it actually didn't work. It simply drove the technologies underground, where they became less stable because the responsible practitioners we rely on to protect us didn't have access to the tools to do that. So the dangers actually were exacerbated. The promise of the technologies were relinquished. So it's really kind of the worst of all worlds. So we do have to deal with the sort of intertwined promise versus peril. And so I want to comment on that as well. My interest in technology trends emerged from my interest in being an inventor. A few decades ago, I realized that my inventions of my colleagues and I had to make sense when the project was finished. And the world, I noticed, was a different place 3 or 4 years later. Everything was different. The enabling technologies, the needs of the market, methods of distribution, development tools, all changed quite dramatically. And most projects fail because, not because the R&D department can't get it to work. Generally, if you read a business plan, those people will get that product to work. And yet, the plan probably will fail because the timing is wrong. Not all the enabling factors will be in place at the same time. We do have boom and bust cycles where the timing is not calculated correctly. In fact, we have this common phenomena where the equity community feels that there is a profound benefit, transformation of business models that will come from a new technology, which leads to an enormous surge of investment and increase in capital values, which tends to be premature. Then when the revolution doesn't happen overnight, there's a bust. But as you'll see from some of the charts I'll show you, the actual power of the technology is measured many different ways in terms of price capacity, bandwidth, computational power, and many other measures. Progresses exponentially very smoothly through boom and bust. In fact, you see no evidence of the boom and bust. And the adoption of the technologies by society, for example, e-commerce, you'll see just smooth exponential progression. It's only the capital values that go through this boom and bust cycle. And we saw that twice in the 19th century with railroads. We saw it with AI, with the so-called AI winter. We saw it with the Internet. We saw it with telecommunications. I hope we don't see it with nanotechnology. There's a little boomlet. I think there's enough awareness. Hopefully there's enough awareness that we can anticipate the benefits of nanotechnology in a realistic way, and there are early adoption technologies in terms of nanoparticles that will have significant effect. So I'm hopeful that we'll avoid that. But the adoption of these technologies and the actual power is remarkably predictable. You'll hear people say, well, you can't predict the future. And if you talk about specific technologies, will G3 or WiMAX or CDMA be the next telecommunication standard? It's very unpredictable. It's even more unpredictable as to which companies will prevail. But if you talk about the actual measures of the number of bits being moved, the bandwidth, the price performance of telecommunications and computation, it's remarkable how predictable those trends are. And one of the sort of fallouts or side effects or benefits of tracking these trends is that we can then invent with the technologies of the future. We can anticipate when the different applications will be viable. We actually have 50% deflation, as I'll show you, in information technologies. This is measured in many different ways. The economists are worried about deflation because we had deflation during the Depression. It seems obvious if you can buy the same amount of capability a year later for half the money that will, while on the surface is a good thing for consumers, will lead to a contraction of economic activity, at least as measured in dollars. But the whole history of information technology shows that that's not the case. As the price performance reaches new levels, new applications open up. I mean, people didn't buy iPods for $10,000 10 years ago. As the price performance reaches different points, new applications open up, and the economic growth in information technology, whether you measure narrowly semiconductors or broader definitions of information technology, has grown 28% per year in dollars over the last 50 years, despite the fact that you can buy twice as much stuff for a dollar every year. The actual paradigm shift rate, the rate of technical progress, the rate at which we go from one paradigm to another, may seem like a difficult thing to measure, but looking at it different ways, I end up with an observation that we're doubling the paradigm shift rate every decade. And that's a profound observation, and most people don't take that into consideration. I was at a conference recently that Time magazine organized on the 50th anniversary of the discovery of DNA. All of the speakers were asked, okay, what will the next 50 years bring? And every speaker used the last 50 years as a model for the next 50 years. And that's clearly not an appropriate comparison because we are accelerating the paradigm shift rate. Every speaker except Bill Joy and myself used that. Bill Joy does understand the acceleration of technology we have. And we do agree on the perils. In fact, he got the idea for the perils from a barroom conversation we had in 1998. We disagree on what to do about it, although I think he has backed off of his sort of strident relinquishment advocacy. Watson, the co-discoverer of DNA, said, well, in 50 years we'll have drugs that enable you to eat as much as you want and remain slim. And I said, Jim, we've actually done that in mice. We've identified the fat insulin receptor gene, which controls the fat intake by the fat cells. We have new technology, RNA interference, it's just emerged in the last couple of years. It's a very effective technology for turning genes off or blocking gene expression. It's a short fragment of RNA that does not have to go into the nucleus. It just has to go into the cell, which is relatively easy to do. If you can identify a gene, it latches onto the messenger RNA outside the nucleus and blocks the expression of that gene. And doing that in mice with the fat insulin receptor gene enabled these mice to eat ravenously. In fact, even especially bred strain of mice that eats a lot, ate enormously, and yet remained slim and got the benefits of caloric restriction without the restriction. And there are five pharmaceutical companies rushing to bring that to human markets. We'll see that in 5 to 8 years, not 50 years. All of the predictions for 50 years were quite tame, unrealistically lame, really, because they fail to take into consideration this acceleration of paradigm shift. So let me quickly show you a few examples of that. telephone, the first virtual reality technology. You could actually be with someone else, even though they were hundreds of miles apart. That is how they viewed the telephone in the 19th century. When you consider that, it never happened before in human history. But it took 50 years to be adopted by a quarter of the U.S. population. Cell phone took about 8 years. If we put different communication technologies on a logarithmic chart, and all of these charts that I'm showing you are logarithmic charts, so as you go up the chart, it represents multiplying generally by a factor of 10, some key measure. Telephone, radio, television took decades to be adopted. Cell phone, the web, only took a few years. Here's a revised chart that I've shown many of you before, and I want to show you a couple other charts on this same issue, but this is a double logarithmic chart. So on the x-axis, it's how many years ago this particular paradigm occurred, and then on the y-axis, how long it took for the next paradigm. And it makes the point that an evolutionary process works by indirection. It creates a capability, and then it uses that capability to bring on the next stage. And that's why an evolutionary process accelerates. And we can actually see that when we simulate evolution in the computer using evolutionary or genetic algorithms. But the first paradigm shift, the creation of cells, of biology, and specifically DNA, so that biology had a little information system, a computer, to keep track of its experiments, took billions of years. But then evolution, biological evolution, used that capability to bring on the next stage. So the Cambrian explosion went relatively quickly when all the body plans of the animals were evolved. It only took about 10 million years. And biological evolution kept accelerating. Homo sapiens evolved in only a few hundred thousand years. And then, again, working through indirection, evolution used one of its creations, a species that combined a cognitive capability with an opposable appendage. And chimpanzees actually don't have a power grip and don't have fine motor coordination. We were the first to be able to do that. So we could use our cognitive capability to manipulate the environment and bring on the next stage, which was human-created technological evolution. And technology really comes out of this double exponential trend in a straight line. And the first step in technology took tens of thousands of years. Stone tools, fire, the wheel kept accelerating half a millennium ago. The printing press, first major communication technology after written language and language itself, took about a century to be adopted, and it's kept accelerating ever since. If you look at these on a linear chart, you see that everything has just happened. But some people criticize this, saying, okay, I only put the points on here which were on the curve and or on the straight line, and something that didn't fit I didn't put on the curve. And that's not true. I've actually done a number of these and actually invited people to look at the data, and some people say, well, the Cambrian explosion didn't take 10 million years, it took 25 million years, and agriculture didn't happen on that date, and the Internet, you really have to go back to the ARPANET, it really should be 25 years. We changed the data, it's still a straight line, because the pervasiveness of this exponential trend is so powerful that it is a double exponential progression. I mean, the Cambrian explosion didn't take 25 years, and the Internet didn't take a million years. But I created another chart where I took 15 different lists, and these lists were not from thinkers or reference books that were trying to necessarily make a point about acceleration. These are just arbitrary lists of key events by different thinkers or reference works on what they thought the key milestones were in biological and technological evolution. So you have American Museum of Natural History, the Encyclopedia Britannica, a list for both biological and technical evolution, Carl Sagan's Cosmic Calendar, and a total of 15 lists. And you get the same progression. You get a little bit of fattening of the curve because people do disagree when agriculture occurred or how long the Cambrian explosion took. And people have different ideas of what the key milestones were, although they're very similar. But the acceleration is very clear. One economist took these lists and grouped them into epochal events of similar nature. Got 28 what he calls canonical milestones. This is Theodore Modus. And again, you get the same kind of progression. The acceleration of a evolutionary process, and both biology and now technological evolution are such processes, is really undeniable. Information technologies accelerate even more quickly. Almost any measure that you take, and I'll show you a couple dozen of these quickly, tends to double every year. And it's remarkably predictable. Personal experience, when I came to MIT, they had basically one computer, took up about half the size of this hall, cost millions of dollars, was shared by thousands of professors and students, less powerful than the computer in your cell phone. Now, Moore's Law is really one example of many. I put 49 different information processing systems on a logarithmic chart over the last century. So the electromechanical equipment used in the 1890 census, and Alan Turing's relay-based machine that cracked the German Enigma code. Then vacuum tubes came in. CBS predicted the election of Eisenhower in 1952. Discrete transistors were used in computers for the space flights in the 60s. And now we've had four decades of progression in integrated circuits. So Moore's law, which is the shrinking of transistors on integrated circuit, is really the fifth paradigm, not the first, to bring exponential growth to the price performance of computing. And you'll notice that's not a straight line. This is a logarithmic graph. A straight line in a logarithmic graph means exponential growth. And that's actually a slow exponential. It took us 3 years to double the price performance of computing in the beginning of the 20th century, 2 years in the middle. We're now doubling it every year. And there's a theoretical reason why there's a second level of exponential growth. As a technology becomes more cost-effective, we use it more. I mean, there were only a handful of computers in 1950. Today, it's a trillion-dollar industry, and that accounts for the second level of exponential growth. Here's a chart from Hans Moravec. These are all different computers than the ones I had. Same progression. He draws different trend lines at different points in time. And the later he takes a trend line, the higher the trend, showing the acceleration of the rate of acceleration. And some charts from Moore's Law. This is an interesting one. 1968, you could buy a transistor for a dollar. And if we go back further to the early 60s, I was hanging around the electronic surplus shops in Canal Street in New York. They're still there, and I'd buy something about this big, which was a relay, telephone relay, with support circuitry, equivalent to one transistor, only a lot slower, because it was 30 or 40 millisecond reset time, so about a million times slower than a transistor, for $30 or $40. But you could buy one fairly fast transistor in 1968 for a dollar. 2002, you could buy 10 million, and this has continued to progress. I mean, look how predictable that trend is. This is not a trend that came out of some tabletop experiment. I mean, this is the result of human chaotic behavior across the world with thousands of companies competing with each other in IPOs and marketing plans and bankruptcies and accusations of countries dumping products on another. And out of all that chaotic behavior, you get a remarkably predictable trend. Now, unlike Gertrude Stein's roses, it's not the case that a transistor is a transistor. As we make them smaller, they're actually better because they're faster. The electrons have less distance to travel. We've had exponential growth in clock speed. So the cost per transistor cycle, which is a better measure of price performance, has been coming down by half every 1.1 year. When you add some other layers of innovation, pipelining, data caching, and other microprocessor innovations, the price performance of computing has been doubling every year, which is 50% deflation. And as I mentioned, the growth in productivity and the amount of information products and processes that constitute the economy is growing faster than that 50% deflation. So we can get twice as much stuff every year, but we make actually more than twice as much stuff. It's actually been growing 28% per year for the last 50 years. Again, very predictably. And right now, information technology is about 8% of the economy, growing at a slow exponential. It will be the majority of the economy by the end of the 2020s. Now, Moore's Law is one example of several that have brought exponential growth to computing. By the way, the sixth paradigm, when Moore's Law runs out of steam, and it will, I mean, it's the first predictions for the end of Moore's Law were 2002, Intel now says 2022, but we will get to the point where the key features are few atoms in width, and we won't be able to shrink the transistors on an IC any further. That just won't be feasible. They're already running into quantum effects, but we're able to use unreliable components using redundancy and error correction codes and so on. So that's already an issue with semiconductors. But we'll go to the sixth paradigm, which is three-dimensional molecular computing. And that's something that's I see is actively on the agenda here. That is already dipped into what some people call the nanotechnology realm of under 100 nanometers, coming generation 65 nanometers and then 40 nanometers. For two-dimensional chips, but we will go into the third dimension. When I wrote about that in my 1999 book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, that was very controversial then, and there's been so much progress with getting self-organizing three-dimensional circuits with nanotubes or even DNA as a computational element and other types of molecules to compute in three dimensions that this is now really a mainstream view. But not only is Moore's Law one of several paradigms to bring exponential growth to computing, but computing is just one example of the exponential growth of information technology. I mean, here's just another arbitrary example, magnetic data storage. This is a different technical problem. It's shrinking magnetic spots on a magnetic substrate. It's different scientists, different companies, different accusations of countries dumping products, and you have, again, very predictable exponential growth, doubling in price performance basically every 15 months. And it's now really up to every 12 months. The biotechnology revolution is really a function of the intersection of information technology and biology. Now, I've had a several-decade interest in health. I had type 2 diabetes in my 30s. The conventional treatment made that worse. So I kind of approached it as an inventor, came up with my own program. I wrote a health book about that and have been free of diabetes for 20 years. And that kind of got me on the path of being very interested in health. And people notice, well, you've got these two interests. You've got interest in computer and information technology, and then you've got this interest in health. And I was interested in health because I was intrigued with the future and wanted to be around. But today, those interests have merged. In fact, I have a book that's coming out next week called Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever, which I've co-authored with Terry Grossman. Some of you know him. He's a leading longevity expert. And in fact, I met him at a Foresight conference in 1999. He became my doctor, and we've been closely collaborating. We had hundreds of emails and thousands of emails, and so now we actually counted about 10,000 emails. We said there's a book here. And so we did organize a book, which is coming out next week, which talks about three bridges to radical life extension. Bridge one is applying today's knowledge, which is really a different topic than this conference, to slow down the aging process. I've done that myself. I've been very serious about this. I take 250 supplements a day. I'm really reprogramming my biochemical pathways. They're completely different than they would be if I wasn't doing this. According to some extensive biological aging tests, I haven't aged much in the last 16 years. When I was 40, I came out at 38. According to an extensive all-day test, includes a lot of biochemical levels and reaction times and other types of measurements. I'm 56 now. I took it again, and I came out at 40. And I'm actually a lot healthier than I was 20 years ago when I had diabetes and high cholesterol levels and so forth. That's all a bridge one to the full flowering of this revolution, the biotechnology revolution, where we're really understanding the information processes underlying biology and disease. And that will be a bridge to the full flowering of the nanotechnology revolution, will have the kinds of capabilities that Rob Freitas talks about and will present to you tomorrow. We're going to be able to go beyond the limitations of biology. You'll hear a lot of people say that biology is remarkably optimal and extraordinarily clever. It is very clever, but it's far from optimal because an evolutionary process does local optimization, and it cannot completely go back and reconsider its assumptions. Assumptions like building everything out of proteins, which, although three-dimensional, are a very limited class of three-dimensional structures because they have to be built out of a one-dimensional string of amino acids. And it's clever, but it's really a one-dimensional type of building block, and proteins have many limitations. Our thinking takes place in interneuronal connections at chemical switching speeds, which are a few hundred feet per second, which is a million times slower than electronic circuits today. And a conservative analysis, which I have in another book that will be coming out next spring, called The Singularity is Near When Humans Transcend Biology, indicates that a cubic inch of nanotube circuitry, at least at its theoretical potential, would be more than 10 million times faster than even the most conservatively high estimates of the computational capacity of the human brain. So in terms of biology, we see the same doubling of price performance or key measures every year. It cost $12 to sequence a base pair in 1990, a penny in 2000. It's now between a tenth and a hundredth of a cent. We're headed towards $1,000 genome. The amount of DNA data has doubled every year that we're collecting as a civilization. In fact, two-thirds through the 15-year genome project, we had collected 2% of the genome. And critics who had criticized it all along said, this is pathetic. I mean, we're two-thirds through the 15-year project, and we've done 2% of the project. How are we going to get it done? But, you know, it's the last seven doublings that go from 1% to 100%, and we got the project done on time. It took 15 years to sequence HIV. We sequenced SARS, a comparably difficult task, in 31 days. And that's because of this dramatic acceleration. Communications, another type of technology. This is not Moore's Law. This is something different. There's actually many different communication technologies, fiber optics, different kinds of wireless protocols. I don't want to belabor this, but we're basically doubling the price performance of many different types of communication technologies every year. The Internet, my first book, The Age of Intelligent Machines, I noticed that we'd gone from 10,000 nodes on the ARPANET to 20,000 a year. And then the next year, we went to 40,000. And I felt that that exponential trend would continue. So 10 years later, it would be 10 million going to 20 million to 40 million to 80 million. And that would be a worldwide phenomenon. We'd see a worldwide information network. So this is the same chart on a linear graph. So we experience technology in the linear domain. We live in a linear world. And so it looked like the Internet just sprung out of nowhere in the mid-1990s. The first reference to the World Wide Web in the New York Times is buried on page 32. It was in 1993. but if you looked at the data on a logarithmic chart, if you looked at the exponential trend, you could see it coming. And another exponential trend is miniaturization. So one way to consider nanotechnology is the inevitable end result of miniaturizing technology, which we're clearly doing in electronics, but we're also doing in mechanical systems. And there's already, of course, early adopter, at least experiments, a little DNA-based robot using DNA as a structural element that can actually walk in a bipedal fashion that was discussed earlier this morning. We have a website. Catherine Moronic is here in the audience, helps us with that, kurzweilai.net, where we have articles every day, and the number of nanotechnology-related articles has been picking up, and it's just remarkable how many substantial steps forward there are every week in this area. But the cutting edge right now in terms of commercial fabrication tends not to be actually nanotechnology quite yet, although there are many applications for nanoparticles. But certainly microelectronic mechanical systems for complex mechanical systems is the state of the art. But we have an actual shrinking, if you measure the key features of commercially realizable mechanical systems, of about between 4 and 5 per linear dimension per decade. And if you project that out, the 2020s will be the golden era of arbitrary nanotechnology, where we can really build complex electromechanical systems that are truly at the sort of atomically precise level. These are some illustrations from Eric Drexler's book. I'm not going to steal Rob Freitas's thunder other than to pay homage to his brilliant conceptual designs. One of the major applications for nanotechnology will be, as I mentioned, this third bridge to radical life extension. We can right now, using today's knowledge, slow down aging and disease processes dramatically, more than people realize, and it's particularly important for baby boomers, so our book is kind of a wake-up call, because there's also an acceleration of these disease processes, like atherosclerosis, as you get to middle age. And that will lead, so we can actually, even baby boomers can remain in good shape, and that's basically, Terry Grossman, my goal, when we have the full realization of biotech. And that can then take us to the sort of full realization of nanotechs and the kind of vision that Rob Freitas has articulated in his really remarkable treatise, Nanomedicine, which has two volumes out now. But his artificial red blood cell is another example of the suboptimality of biology. Because while it's quite remarkable at how intricate these methods are, biology is very suboptimal. Once we reverse engineer it and can recreate it using technology that reconsiders the sort of design parameters of biology, Rob did a conservative analysis. If you replace 10% of your blood, red blood cells with these respirocytes, which are fairly simple devices as these sort of nanobots go, because it just stores and lets out oxygen, and our red blood cells do this very inefficiently. This is thousands of times more capable. So if you replace 10% of your blood, you can do an Olympic sprint for 15 minutes without taking a breath. So I won't steal any more of your thunder. But nanotechnology in our bloodstream will be a very powerful methodology to continue the sort of acceleration of being able to expand human longevity. I mean, ultimately, these nanobots will be able to repair DNA errors, remove debris, destroy pathogens. They won't be subject to autoimmune disorders and so on. Interest in nanotechnology is growing, doubling time 2.4 years in terms of nanotech citations. This is continuing now. We have more data through 2004, and this is continuing. Nanotech-related patents is growing exponentially. If we come back to the double exponential growth of computation, we see that right now $1,000 of computation like this is somewhere between an insect and a mouse brain. Hans Moravec has done an analysis showing the software actually has kept up with the hardware. $1,000 of computation will equal 10 to the 16th calculations per second, which is my estimate of the computational capacity of the human brain. If we had more time, we could debate that some of the estimates are as high as 10 to the 19th. And those assume that every single nonlinearity in the synapses and dendrites and interneural connections is absolutely crucial, and you have to simulate every single thing at the cellular level, subcellular level. I don't believe that's necessary. And a number of experiments on creating simulations of different neural regions shows that that's not necessary. But if that were necessary, it's 10 to the 19th, and then we won't have it till 2023. But clearly, we will. Hardware capability is not going to be a limiting factor. And that was controversial in 1999. I'd say that's pretty much a mainstream view today, that we will have plenty of computation to simulate the human brain. There's many other points one could make here. The brain is actually digitally controlled analog. Carver Mead has done a lot of pioneering work on digitally controlled analog computation. If we can use transistors in their analog mode, you get a thousandfold increase in productivity, because you can multiply two numbers with one transistor. Doing that digitally requires thousands of transistors. So if we actually simulate the analog behavior of interneural connections with analog transistors, you get an improvement in price performance. We're also harvesting Computes on the internet, 99% of the computes are unused, more than 99%. When we get higher bandwidth connections and when we have the worldwide mesh where each computer and handheld device is not just a spoke into the internet where all the nodes are, but actually every device becomes a node, and we have high bandwidth connections between all those nodes, we'll be very easily be able to share computation in our region. So if suddenly you need 1,000 processors or even 1,000,000 processors for some burst of computational capability, you'll be able to organize that, and we'll be actually using all the computes on the internet. The hardware availability is not so controversial anymore. The real question has become, will we have the software of human intelligence, or will we just have extremely fast calculators? And the key issue here is the reverse engineering of the human brain, and nanotechnology will play a key role in that. We actually have exponential growth, again, in the spatial and temporal resolution of brain scanning, the price performance, the bandwidth, the amount of data that we're scanning. I mean, 6 or 7 different ways of measuring brain scanning is basically doubling every year. There are 6 or 7 very exciting new scanning technologies that can scan human brain tissue in vivo in an actual living person. New technology at the University of Pennsylvania that can image 3-dimensional brain tissue with very high temporal resolution, can actually see the individual interneuronal connections in clusters of thousands of neurons. And for the first time, we're actually seeing how the brain works. I mean, trying to reverse engineer the human brain up until very recently has been very difficult. If I asked you to reverse engineer this computer and I gave you a few crude magnetic sensors that were very slow that you could place outside the box, you'd come up with some crude theory that, you know, you're storing something in a database, there seems to be some activity over here. And that's been pretty much the state of the art as of a few years ago in trying to reverse engineer the human brain. It's a small exaggeration, but we're now getting the tools where we can actually see what's going on. I mean, you really would want to be able to put sensors on individual signals and be able to track them at sufficient speed to be able to reverse engineer. And that's exactly what engineers do when they reverse engineer an electronic circuit. We're getting the means now of doing that. And there's many different ways of approaching the problem, developing models of actual neurons, which we can do in vitro, and actually then looking at how these signals self-organize in vivo. And so then a question comes up. We can get all this data, but can we make sense of it? Maybe it's just too complex and too overwhelming for human intelligence to make sense of. Doug Hofstadter muses that, well, maybe our brains are just kind of below that threshold needed to understand our brains. And if we were a lot smarter and able to understand it, well, then necessarily the complexity of our brains would be that much greater and we'd never catch up with it. But what we're finding is that that's actually not the case. As we get the data, we're able to develop models and simulations. The brain is not one big neural net. It's hundreds of different regions. Each region is organized differently, has different patterns, different types of neurons. We actually have very good models now of most of those neurons. We're getting the interconnection data, and we're able to create simulations that are remarkably accurate. I wouldn't say they're perfect, but we are showing that once we get the data, we're able to create models and working simulations. This is work done by Lloyd Watts in California. Each one of these blocks represents a region of the brain that does auditory processing. And we have a lot of information about each of these blocks. And he and his colleagues have actually created a model and a computer simulation of each of these regions and then has applied psychoacoustic tests to this whole simulation of the human auditory preprocessing system. Gets very similar results as doing that to human auditory perception. Putting this, for example, as a front end to speech recognition allows speech recognition to pick out a conversation and track it against the panoply of background sound, something that speech recognition that I worked with was unable to do. So it may not be perfect, but it does show the ability to take the data we're getting and turn it into working models and simulations. We are learning the principles, some of the principles of operation of the brain. There's some similar issues in nanotechnology in that really nanotechnology circuits are going to have to be self-organizing. The brain itself is self-organizing. It's massively parallel. It's chaotic. The overall chaotic behavior is what's important. There tend not to be specific connections that are important. Information has holographic-like properties in that it's not localized. So, you know, random neurons can die and you still get the overall pattern. Interestingly, the brain does not persist. In fact, our body doesn't persist. We've known, of course, that most of our cells have a turnover of days or weeks or months at most. We always thought the neurons actually, which is most closely identified with our sort of concept of who we are, that those did persist, but we're finding actually the components of the neurons, like the tubules and the fibrils and different aspects of the neuron, last very short amounts of time. Like some are measured in hours, days. Within a few weeks, all of the actual stuff in our brain turns over. So if we ask who we are, I mean, this physical instantiation of our being does not last very long. It's really the pattern of information. The pattern tends to be a self-organizing type of information. Now, how complicated is the brain? It's organized like a fractal in that there's fractal complexity at each level, and as you get more and more precise, there's another level of complexity below that. So it looks like it's extremely complex. But the actual design of it is specified in the genome and the supporting molecules, but actually that supporting array of molecules, like the design of the ribosomes and enzymes and so on, that allow the biochemical machinery to work, actually has relatively, you can characterize that with very little information compared to the genome. The genome is the bulk of the information. Now, the genome is 800 million bytes. It turns out the junk DNA is not junk, although there was an interesting mouse experiment recently where they took out huge amounts of preserved sections of junk DNA, and these mice seem to be fine. But let's assume that the junk DNA is not junk. It does seem to play a role in gene expression. It's nonetheless replete with redundancies. One sequence called ALU is repeated 300,000 times, comprises 3% of the genome. If you apply standard data compression to the genome, you get down to about 30 million bytes. You can argue about that number. It's called 50 million bytes. That's not very much information. I mean, it's smaller than Microsoft Word. And you might say, now, wait a second. The brain, even conservatively, has thousands of trillions of bytes of information to characterize, you know, my brain or your brain. How can it be specified by 20, 30, 40 million bytes of design information? Well, we know from, you know, algorithm development, we could have a genetic algorithm that's fairly compact, that creates thousands of or millions of copies of itself. They sort of self-organize and compete with each other in a simulated evolutionary environment, and they interact with a complex environment, and then they ultimately end up absorbing information about that complicated environment, and they end up with a lot more information, perhaps thousands or millions of times more information than the program that created this genetic algorithm. So we can create very complex systems that are characterized fairly simply or relatively simply, and the brain actually works that way. There's very little genetic code that describes the wiring of the cerebellum, which is half the neurons in the brain. It describes one pattern of four different neurons, then it says repeat 5 billion times and add a little bit of variation each time. And that's basically what the genome says. And it's very little data describing the wiring of the cerebellum. But then that cerebellum, which is where we do our skill formation, walking, talking, catching a fly ball. We saw some pretty good examples of cerebellum training in the Yankee Red Sox series over the last few days. And if you take a person's cerebellum, you can't characterize it with a few thousand bytes of genetic information. You would need trillions of bytes of information. But the design of it is actually a few thousand bytes. And there is a simulation of the cerebellum that is actually quite accurate, that develops skills similarly to what we know about the cerebellum. I'll just touch on this, but I mentioned how this acceleration of price performance is driving economic growth. So one economist, well, you can see the Depression and World War II, otherwise the different recessions, which get a lot of political attention every 4 years, are very, very small ripples on what is basically exponential growth in the economy. One economist says, well, that's all due to the exponential growth of the population, but we see the same thing on a per capita basis. And really what's driving it is this increase in productivity. This is an hour, the value of an hour of labor in dollars, despite the fact you can buy a lot more for a dollar. But it went from $30 to $130 in 50 years. And this is an average hour of labor, including, you know, people working at McDonald's or factories. I mean, this has basically been an improvement in productivity due to this type of technology. And here's that chart about e-commerce. Smooth, this is about doubling every year. Right now, e-commerce, B2B and B2C, is about $1 trillion. You don't see the boom and the bust in here. So the adoption by society of this technology is just totally smooth. It was Wall Street that went overboard and saying, well, this is revolutionary, which is true. But even an exponential growth doesn't happen instantly. In fact, exponential growth goes very slowly until you reach the knee of the curve, and then it explodes. We're getting able to get some traction now with e-commerce. It was only the equity values that went through the boom and the bust. IT, information technology, is now about 8% of the economy, growing exponentially. It's deeply influential on everything else. So we get to the end of this decade, at least in computation. Electronics is going to be so small, we're not going to really notice it very much. It's going to be in our clothing. Images will be written directly to our retina from our eyeglasses and contact lenses. I've used that type of technology. I advised the Army as part of the Army Science Advisory Board, and they extensively use these systems to put soldiers in virtual reality environments so that they can feel like they're inside a weapon, for example, the armed predator, where there is a human flying it who is in a virtual reality environment, just doesn't happen to be inside the weapon. Weapons are actually dangerous places to be, so we're trying to take the people out of them. Even if you have a person inside, let's say an Abrams tank, which due to some pretty advanced technology, including technology can be called nanotechnology because of the material science that's being used at the molecular level, has kept that actually a pretty safe environment. There's only been 3 casualties in 20 years of use of the Abrams tank. But you don't expect the soldier to look outside the window. They're actually also in these virtual reality environments. But these systems will be very inexpensive, very high resolution by the end of the decade. We'll be online all the time. We'll have augmented real reality. So as we look at somebody, remind us who they are, that their birthday is next week. You look at a building, it'll tell you something about that building. If we go out to 2029, we will be in the golden era of nanotechnology. We'll be in the dawn of strong AI, in my view, non-biological intelligence, which will benefit from nanotechnology. Really, the project of reverse engineering the human brain will be finished by the ability to go inside the brain with nanobots, robots the size of blood cells, which is not as futuristic as it may sound to some, because there's extensive discussion at this conference, but many places I talk, they've never heard of this, but there are many early adopter examples. I mean, one scientist has cured type 1 diabetes with a 1-micron device that's nano-engineered with 7-nanometer pores that actually puts out insulin in a controlled fashion, blocks antibodies. It's a pretty clever device, and it cures type 1 diabetes in rats, and they're now gearing up to experiment with that in humans. So there are early adopter examples of nanobots. Nanobots are not nanometer-sized devices, as I'm sure you appreciate. They're more like micron-sized devices. The key features are measured in nanometers. But ultimately, we'll be able to send devices into the brain through the capillaries to scan the brain from inside. But that really will provide the high-resolution information we need to complete that job. So nanotechnology will facilitate the reverse engineering of the brain. And we're not going to just copy the brain, but we're going to be able to expand our AI toolkit. Most of that toolkit today Some of it's biologically inspired by what little we know about how the brain works, which is rapidly increasing. But there hasn't been that much contribution yet from reverse engineering the brain in AI, which is the field that I work in. But that is changing now. We're actually getting a lot of information, such as Lloyd Watts' work, which is being put into speech recognition. And as we really understand how the brain works, its principles of operation, we'll be able to greatly accelerate and expand the AI toolkit to develop strong AI. So non-biological intelligence ultimately will combine the pattern recognition powers of human intelligence. That's what we're really good at. We're not actually very good at doing logical and analytical thinking. I mean, if you compare chess machines, a computer can actually calculate out billions of different move, counter-move sequences totally accurately. And Kasparov was asked, well, you know, your machine opponent does 300 million board analyses per second. How many do you do? And he said less than one. So how is it that he can hold up to a machine? It's because of the power of pattern recognition. That is how human experts work. And he has studied 100,000 board positions. That's actually a real number of the number of patterns or chunks of knowledge that a human expert in a field learns, and that's why it takes, you know, a decade or two to become an expert in an area. So he looks at the board and he immediately says, oh, yeah, this is very similar to that pattern, to that board that Grandmaster so-and-so encountered a few years ago when he forgot to protect his trailing pawn. I better remember to do that. But non-biological intelligence ultimately will combine those pattern recognition capabilities with ways in which machines are already greatly superior to us. They can remember billions of things accurately. They master a skill. They can do it very quickly and repetitively. And most importantly, they can share their knowledge. We can share our knowledge at the very slow bandwidth of language. Machines can share it much more rapidly. And the real killer app of nanotechnology is going to be nanobots in our bodies, in our brains, in the environment to reverse the pollution from the industrial era, in solar panels to provide renewable energy. A fraction of a percent, if we were to capture a fraction of a percent of the sunlight falling on the Earth, we could meet our energy needs, even as projected for the year 2030, which is substantially higher than today. Solar panels today are expensive. They run at fairly low efficiencies. There are many conceptual designs for nanotechnology-based solar panels that would be extremely inexpensive. In fact, there are some companies now that are pursuing early adopter nanotechnology for this application that have pretty impressive 30, 40, 50% efficiencies, or at least claim to, and ultimately will be pretty inexpensive. I think by the end of the decade, we'll see solar power begin to really become competitive with other types. But it's going to be on this exponential curve of coming down rapidly in price. We're going to see fossil fuels and things actually continue to go up in price because there's only a limited amount of them. There actually are more types out there, but they're more and more expensive to get at. So ultimately, nanotechnology-based energy resources such as solar power and then stored in nanotechnology-based fuel cells will become a bigger and bigger factor in energy. I'm involved with one company that is building at least MEMS-based nanocells with, they have a postage stamp size device that would run your cell phone for many hours. One of the implications of nanobots in the capillaries of the brain will be the opportunity to interact with our biological neurons. If we have millions or billions of nanobots in our brain, we've already shown the ability of non-invasive two-way communication between electronic devices and electronics. There's a number of different examples of that. So we'll be able to provide virtual reality from within the nervous system, but ultimately have intimate connection between our biological thinking and our non-biological thinking. Non-biological thinking already has a foothold in at least some of our brains. There are several different FDA-approved neural implants. The latest generation of the Parkinson's disease implant, which replaces neurons that have been destroyed by that disease and interact with the biological neurons in the vicinity. And those other biological neurons are perfectly happy to get signals from this electronic device. The latest version can download new software from outside the patient. But once we can do this non-invasively and non-biological intelligence begins to play a role in our bodies and brains, it will grow exponentially. That is the nature of non-biological intelligence, of any information technology. Our biological thinking is fixed. I put it at 10 to the 26 calculations per second for the whole human race. The highest estimates are 10 to the 29th. But 50 years from now, it's going to be the same figure. The crossover point will be somewhere in the 2020s. By 2030s, the non-biological intelligence of our civilization will be significantly more capable. But in my view, it's still human intelligence because it's going to be derived from the principles of operation of human intelligence. It is emerging from within our civilization, and we're going to literally merge with it. So I was going to talk a little bit about promise versus peril. One of the promises is expansion of human life expectancy. We have already dramatically improved our life expectancy. Nanotechnology is going to continue to do that. Basically, we cannot relinquish our way out of these risks, and the risks are real. We have an existential risk already with biological technologies. The same technology that will save millions of lives from cancer and other diseases could also be applied by a knowledgeable bioterrorist to create a stealthy, easily transmittable, deadly biological virus. I mean, that's not talked about much. We talk about other dangers, but that's actually an existential danger that exists right now. The real answer to that is not to relinquish biology. We're not going to biological technologies. We're not going to tell the millions of cancer sufferers, well, we're getting close to treatments that will be very effective, but we're going to cancel all that because we're concerned about the downside. And as I mentioned before, that wouldn't work. The real answer is to accelerate the defensive technologies. We have some emerging technologies that are very broad spectrum in terms of being able to combat viral diseases. For example, RNA interference. We could develop a system that when a new virus breaks out, we could sequence it quickly, create an RNA interference drug, replicate that very quickly and get that out to the world. And within days, this is really a feasible scenario, we could combat a new emergent biological hazard. We've seen some new biological hazards, apparently naturally, but the potential exists. And the knowledge to do this actually is much more widespread than the knowledge to create an atomic bomb and potentially much more damaging. The knowledge exists in routine college laboratories to create a bioengineered virus, which would be much more dangerous than some of the biological weapons that we talk about, like smallpox. Inherently, technology is a double-edged sword. We will have the same issue with nanotechnology. We're really not there yet. I mean, the issue that's discussed now in terms of environmental dangers of nanoparticles and so on, that's a legitimate issue. I think the regulatory process we have in place is capable of handling that. I mean, that's a whole complicated discussion, but the gray goo problem is a real problem, but the answer is not to relinquish it. There's been some discussion recently that nanotechnology-based molecular manufacturing would not need to use self-replicating entities, and that's certainly true. We're not going to create nanofactories that allow runaway self-replication, and things like Ralph Merkel's strategy for not providing replicating devices with their own replication codes will be effective for any type of practical application that we wish to use. But the broadcast architecture can be defeated by someone who wanted to defeat it. And there are applications that will require self-replicating entities. And we will ultimately need a nanotechnology immune system, just as we've created an immune system for software pathogens. I mean, we do have a new self-replicating entity that is human-made. It didn't exist 20 years ago, the software pathogen, and we have evolved an immune system to deal with it. And what's encouraging is how well that works. I mean, occasionally some new, very clever pathogen that plants something on a popular website and then something else comes and activates it. And they're pretty clever. Within hours, or certainly a day or two, the technological immune system that the virus security community deals with puts out a pretty effective response to that. What does concern me, though, is that the regulatory environment we have, certainly in biology, and that we may end up having in nanotechnology, could actually slow that down. I mean, somebody comes up with a defense for a new software virus, it's out on the internet within hours. You can't do that in biology. The FDA slows things down. It can take 5 to 8 years. A would-be bioterrorist doesn't have to put his or her inventions through the FDA. But the scientists that we're counting on to protect us do have to do that. So streamlining regulation actually is going to be a key issue. I've actually described the idea of applying the broadcast architecture to biology, and ultimately, this might sound futuristic, but I think we'll see this in a few decades, augment or even replace the little computer we have in each cell, which is the DNA in the nucleus, with a nanobot and a nanocomputer that would have the replication codes, and then it could actually follow the broadcast architecture. And so if replication got out of control, it could be recalled or stopped. We could correct DNA errors. We could upgrade the DNA code. This approach would eliminate cancer and biological viral diseases, although I think other techniques will get there first. So I've mentioned relinquishment is not the answer. Really, the answer is to greatly increase our investment in defensive technologies. It is a race. We're not going to be able to relinquish ourselves out of this issue. We would be relinquishing the promise, which is profound, while actually making the dangers worse by depriving the scientists we're counting on to protect us from the tools they need to do that job. So we need to raise public awareness of both promise and peril. We do have an increase in fundamentalism, and not just religious fundamentalism or Islamic fundamentalism, which we're seeing, but we have humanist fundamentalism and environmental fundamentalism that, for example, in the GMO, anti-GMO movement, which has taken a very strident position against any modification using genetic modification of organisms. The founder of Greenpeace has recently quit because of that, the inflexible position against golden rice, which could save millions of kids from going blind, despite a very strong safety record. That is basically a fundamentalist. I mean, the anti-GMO movement, which is at least that portion of it that's just reflexively anti-technology, is a fundamentalist movement, in my view, in that there is an idea that we shouldn't change the way nature created biology or people, despite enormous benefits and opportunity to overcome suffering that these technologies will bring. We need to keep the progress going. It will keep going unless we want to adopt a worldwide totalitarian system. But therefore, we need to increase our priority on developing the defensive technologies. Thank you very much.
You said that there are applications that will require self-replicating nanotech. I've found it hard to think of ones where even self-replication would be more efficient than replication or than fabrication in a factory. Can you give some examples?
Well, one example that we ultimately, this is kind of at the extreme end of accelerating AI, although according to my models we'll get there by the end of this century, we ultimately will come close to saturating the matter and energy in our vicinity with our intelligence. And we will then want to spread out from Earth and to other parts of the solar system and other parts of the galaxy, so on. Really, the best way to do that is to send self-replicating nanobots. That's the most efficient type of mission that we would send. We're not going to send, it's very unrealistic, I believe, to send large biological creatures, and they really can't even go close to the speed of light. But you could send self-replicating nanobots at very close to the speed of light. They could then reach another planet, self-replicate in place. You can then send information to them. Most of the complexity could be sent as pure information, but you would need self-replication. Another reason for self-replication really here on Earth, more immediate, is for a nanotechnology immune system. Because of the possibility of abuse of this technology, and although we're going to use things like the broadcast architecture and follow the foresight guidelines on ethical nanotechnology, and those guidelines are patterned on the Asilomar biotechnology guidelines, which have worked very well so far. But just as in biology, we really can't count on that. We do realize that people will find reasons to be destructive, and the means to be destructive with the biological technologies, that's the threshold we're on now, are pretty widespread. That knowledge and the tools to do that are more widespread than building atomic bombs, which is actually pretty difficult. So therefore, we have to create an immune system in biology and augment our natural immune system to deal with that danger. When we get to the point where self-replicating nanotechnology is feasible, and some of the recent work shows it's not that complicated. One study recently, which I believe is being discussed at this conference, shows that the complexity of a Pentium computer is sufficient to create a self-replicating device. So once we have these very powerful tools in the 2020s, say, it will be feasible for people to not follow the guidelines and try to be destructive and create self-replicating nanotechnology that could be a danger. We will need ultimately, there's no alternative but to create some kind of technological immune system. That's exactly what we've done with software viruses. And that immune system will have to have some self-replicating capabilities, which is exactly what our immune system has in our human bodies. It has self-replication capabilities. In fact, when that gets out of control, we have autoimmune diseases. I mean, Bill Joy made the point in his article that, well, we don't want a nanotechnology immune system because that would be a big danger. But there's really no alternative. Our immune system right now is a big danger because of autoimmune diseases. But no one would suggest that we do without an immune system because of the possibility of autoimmune diseases. We wouldn't last very long. So we will need some kind of nanotechnology-based immune system, just as biology does, just as we have that in the software world. We'll need it in the nanotechnology world. That will need self-replication. Then the point can be made, oh, well, that immune system could be a danger because it looks like the stealth part of a two-step stealth attack by self-replicating nanotechnology. But, of course, the immune system is designed to protect us, not attack us, so long as someone doesn't subvert the software controlling it. Ultimately, the key issue for civilization is going to be actually software integrity. I mean, the little skirmishes we have now with software pathogens and software security is going to ultimately be the most important issue that we confront when we have software running inside our bodies and brains and software controlling nanotechnology and so on.
I'm not completely sure that an immune system would need to self-replicate either for rapid response time or for flexibility. Can we talk further about this?
Sure.
Okay, thanks.
My question is about exponential curves versus S-curves. Now, it's obvious that certain things that you are noting are very linear on a log normal scale will have certain limits. For example, I doubt that the number of nanotechnology references in the literature can continue to the point where all the matter in the universe consists of nanotechnology references. There would seem to be certain kinds of limits on certain things. Now, they're probably so far out in certain ways that it doesn't matter from the point of view of the general theme of this talk. But what do you see as being the ultimate limits on many of the curves that we're looking at? What point do they S out?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, if you look at the exponential growth of information technology as a percentage of the economy, it's growing exponentially, but it can't go beyond 100% as a percentage. So all exponential curves have a reach an asymptote, and therefore are an S curve. I'm showing you here. We actually see that the ongoing growth of many technologies is a sequence of S curves. We're getting enough data now on our computer graphs to see that what looked like an ongoing sweep actually was made up of little S curves. A particular technology or paradigm, like Moore's law, grows exponentially, and then exponential looks totally flat for a while, and then it kind of takes off when it hits the knee of the curve. But then it reaches a limit of its capability of that paradigm, and then it levels off. And so you have a stretched out S, and that's an S curve. What we find out in, say, computation is that when a particular paradigm hits an S curve, it creates pressure for research to create the next paradigm, and we've seen that already five times in the history of computation. And we're seeing it again now, even though we're at least a decade, if not more, away from running out of the Moore's law paradigm of shrinking transistors on a flat integrated circuit. Already there's been tremendous interest in three-dimensional self-organizing circuits, which is the sixth paradigm. So every time one paradigm ran out of steam, it created another one. One could ask the question, and should ask the question, what is the ultimate limit of matter and energy in our vicinity to embody computation or communication? And I've actually just written a chapter on that, which will be in this book that will come out next year, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology, talking about, you know, what are those limits. And there's been a lot of theoretical work on that. We can actually store quite a bit of information at the molecular level. We can do computation with very small molecular devices organized in three dimensions. Energy and heat, of course, becomes a key issue. We will ultimately move to reversible computing. Eric Drexler's Rod computer is actually a reversible computer where the energy that's dissipated is captured and reused. Ed Fredkin at MIT has done an analysis that reversible computing, in theory, uses no energy at all except for two things. I mean, if you consider a rock, there's a lot of, you know, computation going on in it. It's pretty useless, but there's a lot of computational activity, and it's not using energy, and it's not generating heat. But if you want to do useful computation, there are a couple of things you need. You need to communicate the results. Those are not reversible. Those are irreversible operations, and those do generate heat and require energy. That's actually not that much. I mean, most, generally, if you consider a computer program, it's doing lots of computation, and then finally it puts out fairly small amount of information. So communication tends to be a small requirement. The real thing is that computers make errors, and as they get smaller and smaller, there'll be increasing levels of errors from thermal effects and quantum effects. And to correct an error is also an irreversible operation that, again, requires heat. But you can actually reduce the energy and heat requirements by at least eight orders of magnitude if you're not generating heat and requiring energy for every computation, just for the occasional error correction. The computational capabilities are quite daunting. I think it came out to about 10 to the 50th calculations per second for a kilogram of matter. If you allow it to get very hot, if you want a cold computer, you can only do about 10 to the 42 calculations per second, but that would allow us to simulate the entire human race as far as biological thinking is concerned, you know, at least a billion times over. So those limits are quite daunting. They will allow these curves to go through the 21st century and just use matter and energy in our vicinity. So it'll be a while before we need to actually go outside of this region of the universe. But ultimately, we'll do that as well. But the real key energy and material needs for computation and communication, which is really what all of these technologies require, is very, very small and will allow these curves to go on for quite a long time.
Let's take two more questions, and then we're going to ask everybody else who wants to ask questions to come down in the front, and the rest of us who are exhausted are going to go out the back. So I think we have one
and
in the back.
I'm going to go this way here.
We have one in the back, and then we have one up front, and then everybody else with their hand up, please come down front.
Yeah. Hello? Here. In the back?
In the back.
I was wondering, you know, you listed those set of epochal events all through history on that log scale. But it's hard to tell if that's really measuring when epochal events happened or whether we remember epochal events worse as they get further away. I mean, we only remember the really big things from, you know, 10 to the 6th or 8th years ago or something. Have you really thought to analyze all the developments in the horseshoe or other technologies and mid-range distances where we might go back and say, wow, you know, there really were only 25 years between that stirrup and the next stirrup or something like that?
There is a fair amount of judgment. One can take issue with it, but if you look at this conceptually, you know, a billion years ago, not much happened in a millennium ago. If you look at the different scientific and technological advances, not much happened. This pace of progress, of technological change, is accelerating. It is difficult to come up with an absolutely sound methodological procedure for measuring this. I did take these 15 different lists, which we're not trying to make this point, that do show this exponential trend. I mean, key events in biological evolution did not happen in even millenniums, if you look at the history of biology. And the key developments did accelerate because evolution is able to use its capabilities. It could use DNA to bring on the next stage. It could use body plans to bring on cognitive development. It could use more advanced cognitive development to bring on the next stage. We see that in technology. The first computers took years to develop because they were designed pencil on paper and then wired with screwdrivers. And now a computer can be designed in a matter of days by putting in some formulas that look in a programming language in 12 different layers of intermediate design are computed automatically. So there is a basis for this acceleration. And I'm open to other ideas for how we can measure this, but the reality of it is apparent no matter how you try to measure it. And what is unarguable is the acceleration of the power of information technologies. And ultimately, information technologies is going to encompass all of technology. I mean, nanotechnology, Eric has made this point many times, has many of the characteristics of information technology in that we can define a particular transformation and then multiply it by millions and billions and trillions, just as we do with sequences of instructions in a computer. No matter how we measure information, whether it's price performance of computation or communication or the amount of DNA sequencing data or the resolution of brain scanning, literally many dozens, hundreds of different measures of different technologies that have to do with information where we can actually get a clear quantification, it accelerates pretty rapidly, right now doubling typically every year.
I've noticed there's been a fair amount of discussion about the more spectacular perils, or supposed perils of these technologies and the exponential growth, for example, by Bill Joy. But what would you speculate would be the effects perhaps on human psychology and also on the broader economic scale of having things like tabletop manufacturing assembly, or basically having almost every important economic process being done by a machine instead of a human?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. We're well along that path. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. If you look at manufacturing today, you can get very complex, stunningly complex products. It costs very little. What you can get in electronics for $50 or $60, it's not just electronics, elaborate mechanical systems as well. It's pretty remarkable. Manufacturing is already very efficient because it is heavily information intensive. We have computer assisted design creating the design and just-in-time inventory systems controlling the procurement of parts and automated assembly, putting the systems together. And we're not that far from manufacturing already being inexpensive raw materials that are pretty basic that get turned in to high-quality products. The sort of vision of a tabletop fabricator that can take very inexpensive, you know, stock materials and turn them into products through information designs is the ultimate sort of asymptote of that, but we're not that far away from that already. And if you measure the information content of different products, even products like tables and chairs, which are also manufactured in these very efficient factories and so on, it is asymptoting up towards 100%, and different classes of products are different places on that curve. So it's going to be a continuation of improvement of price performance. It wasn't that long ago if someone took out a portable phone in a movie, that was an indication that this was a really powerful, wealthy person, because only the power elite could afford a portable phone. And now you have countries in Asia where 15 years ago the majority of the population was pushing a plow, and today they have vibrant information economies and everybody has a cell phone. It's the nature of technology to start expensive and actually not working that well. And right now the gap is about 10 years to where it actually works well and is inexpensive. That 10-year process is going to shrink along with this ongoing acceleration of paradigm shift. So we tend to get used to these progressions, particularly the beneficial aspect of it. It will lead to greater wealth, provided that the societies are free. I mean, the places where we don't have democracy, such as the Arab countries, have not benefited from this, and where we have had free sharing of information and free economic systems, the wealth creation of these accelerating information technologies has been quite apparent. It is leading to an increasing reflexive reaction to technology. There's a strong anti-technology movement, which I alluded to earlier, which is growing as technology is encompassing more and more things. I mean, my interest has always been in information technology. Well, that used to be computers, but now it's deeply affecting everything. I mean, you can't speak to anyone, musician, a librarian, anybody in any field of work who isn't deeply immersed in information technologies, and there is an acceleration of change, and it's leading to an anti-technology movement that is really not well-grounded, because trying to relinquish the benefits of these technologies is not going to avoid the dangers. Any broad-scale attempt at that will only make them worse. But that is one of the effects. I think we'll see a continued increase in the sort of anti-technology reaction. I think it's unfortunate that, you know, at least some segments of the environmental movement have moved in that direction. So I think it's important to have communication about how the dangers can be dealt with, to develop, to anticipate that. I mean, the Foresight Institute didn't try to argue that the dangers aren't real. And some scientists take that approach. I mean, Smalley's last letter to Eric Drexler said, "You're scaring our children." I think that reveals some of the motivation not to get into this issue of danger, because it's there's a concern that people aren't going to understand it and it's going to lead to opposition to these technologies. I think the real issue is to deal with the danger of technology. Technology's always been a double-edged sword. We don't have to look further than the 20th century to see that. We need to put our effort into constructive ethical guidelines and technological solutions to confront the dangers. We've done a pretty good job so far. If we look at software viruses, we're actually doing a good job. We need to do as well a job with biology, which is really the threshold we're on now, nanotechnology when that becomes an issue. Robotics will also have similar downsides. Continue to also articulate the benefits. People tend to get used to the benefits quickly, and they lose perspective as to how what life was like. A lot of people want to go back to the good old days when things were natural and we didn't have technology, but human lifespan was 37 in 1800. There were no social safety nets. Most people lived lives of dire poverty. A single disaster would make a family, would put a family into desperation, and there were lots of disasters because there were no antibiotics and so forth. So life was very, very hard even 200 years ago. We've come a long way. There's still a lot of suffering to overcome. We're getting the tools, say, in biology to actually understand precisely the information processes underlying atherosclerosis and cancer and diabetes, and developing very smart tools, new medications that are not the sort of broad, crude medications we've seen in the past, but that very precisely target a specific biochemical reaction that have very few side effects. Drug development used to be kind of like early primitive tool development, where primitive man and woman would find a tool like, oh, here's a good rock, this would make a good hammer. And we didn't have the means of shaping our tools. And drugs really were like that up until recently. We're now getting the means of sharply shaping these tools to do beneficial things. So we need to promote these benefits of technology while we intelligently manage the perils.
No, I'm sorry.
I'm able to hear this question. You said that we are suboptimal, and you said that machines are already vastly superior to us in some ways. And I'm just wondering how you make those judgments.
Can we do this in the later discussion?
Well,
I just want everyone to hear that issue posed.
Well, let me address what I said. Human intelligence right now is actually, for certain tasks, like pattern recognition, significantly superior to people, to machines. But as we understand how specific biological systems work, we realize that it's possible to engineer them to be significantly superior. Rob Freitas's respiracyte is a good example of that. For example, for the task of carrying oxygen, we can design something that works a lot better. Our internal connections process hundreds of calculations per second. Electronics is already a million times faster. So we can continue this process of overcoming human suffering. Cancer is not optimal. I mean, our biological systems are subject to disease, to cancer, to suffering. These are things that we can overcome as we understand the information processes underlying these problems that we have with biology. Human beings were not evolved to live much past childbearing age, because when our genes evolved, which is tens of thousands of years ago, which is a very different era than exists today, it wasn't in the interest of the species for people my age, for example, my daughter's about to go off to college, to stick around very long. But we live in an era now where all of us can contribute to knowledge. That's a unique aspect of human civilization. We are the only species that creates knowledge, and all of us can contribute to that as we overcome some of these problems we have with our biological reality, such as disease. Thank you very much.
Okay. Great.